Okay, the Senate Committee on Human Services will come to order. Welcome. Happy Monday. Isn't Monday the best day?
President's Day.
Happy President's Day. I'm so glad to spend the holiday with all of you. So I am going to... Senator Knope, would you be willing to read the motion for the committee measure introduction? I slide it down your way.
What is it? What are you committing to? I don't know.
what is this one?
This one is Commission for the Blind.
Well, there you go.
There you go. So I'm going to open up a work session on possible introduction of committee measures. And again, as might have just been clear, this is not an indication of support of this measure. It's a matter of courtesy to put it into the process, and it does not, our vote for introduction is not a vote on the merits or the content of the concept, nor does it guarantee the draft will be referred back to this committee, nor that it will be scheduled for a hearing, nor that anybody on this panel will support the bill in any form.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With that ironclad guarantee, Chair Gelser, I move that the following legislative concept be introduced as committee bill, and that would be LC 1667, so 1667, and dated 11/28/16.
Senator Knope moves that LC 1667, dated 11/28/16, be introduced as a committee measure. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. We'll close the work session on committee measures. We are, there were late-breaking developments on Senate Bill 104, so we're not opening that work session. We will repost that at a later date at the request of the Department of Human Services. So I know that we have Senator Farioli coming at 1:15, so we'll open the first hearing. Hopefully we'll get through that, but we'll move to Senator Farioli when he arrives. So we're going to go and we're going to jump around. We're going to start with Senate Bill 310. I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 310.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 310 authorizes city or county to designate areas within their jurisdiction as vertical housing development zones, and it removes the Housing and Community Services Department from the designation process. It establishes requirements for the city or county to certify vertical housing development projects within the zone. It sets an operative date of January 1st, 2018, and the measure takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment sine die.
Thank you so much. And we have Aaron Doyle and Gwen Baldwin. Welcome.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle here on behalf of League of Oregon Cities. Senate Bill 310 is a simple bill in a complex package. The Vertical Housing Development Zone program has existed for over 10 years and has helped a handful of communities across the state to develop mixed use or redevelop mixed use properties to include more housing within specific zones inside their city. This program has been used from Grants Pass to Gresham to LeGrand. In a nutshell, the way the program currently works, a city designates a specific area within the city limits as a vertical housing development zone, in which any project which creates mixed-use properties and place housing on floors above commercial space can provide a limited property tax abatement that is tied to the number of floors of housing. The Oregon Housing Community Services Department, or OHCS, must then certify the zone. Within that zone, for each floor of housing, the development produces a 20% tax abatement from the value of the improvements. If the development includes an equalized floor of affordable units, then an additional 20% can be abated on the value of the land. This program helps cities to work to bring targeted, dense development, and for some communities, this is as simple as rehabilitating a building in the main street, and for others, it is creating a larger mixed-use project on undeveloped lands. Once the city designates a zone, they then reach out to other taxing districts to allow them to opt out of the abatement program. After that, the city reaches out to OHCS to have every project certified that is actually built that meets the requirement of the program. At the end of the day, this program has helped some communities in Oregon create denser housing options in a way that works for the developers and the community. But when we worked to renew the program in the 2015 session, OHCS approached us to see if we would amend the program requirements to the to shift the process of certification from OHCS back to the local government. However, during the circumstances of the session, we asked to wait to shift that oversight until the next long session, and we are now back to fulfill that request. So Senate Bill 310 seems like a substantive bill due to its length, but it merely shifts the certification process from OHCS to the local government. And it will be the local government that then informs the property tax assessor that the project meets the requirements of the program and therefore should receive its abatements. This bill puts this local option on par with other similar programs that have the local entity adopting the abatement to also certify the projects receiving the abatement. In order to simplify the process of getting any new project certified, I urge support of Senate Bill 310. And I appreciate your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the Senate Committee on Human Services, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. My name is Gwen Baldwin, and I represent the city of Beaverton. And Beaverton is a very strong supporter of this very simple and narrow bill, Senate Bill 310, in part because we, back in 2015, were very eager to see the program extended in its reauthorization because we had projects that weren't quite ready to go but now are. And so we're very excited that we have two projects that are under construction and one that is currently in this review process awaiting the certification from Housing Community Services. These projects are really speak to the value for a community like Beaverton. They are in commercial areas that haven't had housing before. By exercising this abatement, we are able to attract projects that are adding housing where they hadn't been before, revitalizing what had been stalled or non-revitalized downtown core or challenging pieces of property. All these properties that we have were things that were once held by the city, so they weren't creating any property tax income anyway. And today we have two projects, again, that are under construction that are bringing together housing, commercial development, and the Westgate project, which is the one that's expected to break ground this spring, has 6,000 square feet of commercial, great commercial space, is near light rail and bus lines, and will bring more than, let me just double check here, 230 units of housing, both market and affordable. So it really is the type of development and revitalization that is exciting. And to be able to have simplicity of being able to say, this is the program area that we're targeting for the revitalization, this meets the criteria, and keep that everything consolidated in the local level would be really terrific. And we also appreciate the fact that the Housing Community Services Department has a lot on their plate and a lot to do, and this simplifies things for everyone. So we encourage your support for Senate Bill 310 and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Senator Jimbo.
Thanks. So Gwen, am I right in assuming that Senate Bill 310 kind of gives us the broad parameters of what a vertical housing program would be, but then it's up to the individual city to put the fine touches on that and the implementation and enforcement?
Yes, that would be my understanding. The length of this is in part because we're taking the components that have been in rule and putting them into statute.
Further questions?
No, that's.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 310?
Oh, I did have a question.
There is a question.
Would you, Madam Chair, would you know if there would be any opposition to this?
Chair Gelser, Senator Mona Sanderson, we are not aware of any opposition at this time because this is really
from home builders or anybody?
No. In 2015, the development community came out in strong support of this program, but because this bill simply shifts who's the final certifier, there hasn't been much discussion because it doesn't go to the merits, but the development community has been strongly supportive, have had folks who advocate for denser housing.
Thank you. And that's a good question. We do have this scheduled for a possible work session on Wednesday, so if people are aware or have concerns, it would be good to let us know before Wednesday.
We're happy to follow up on any questions you have as well. Thank you, Madam
Thank
Chair.
You. Thank you. And last call, anybody want to be heard on Senate Bill 310? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 310. So Senator Farioli is coming in like 3 minutes. The other bill is going to take a while. So I'm going to suggest that we stand at ease until 1:15 rather than starting and jumping back. Is that okay with everybody? Okay. So we are at ease until 1:15. Okay, we are back, and I'm opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 434.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 434 creates a task force on wildfire damage financial relief. It requires the task force to develop recommendations regarding the qualifications for financial assistance from wildfire damage housing relief account. It requires the task force to report findings and recommendations to an interim committee of the Legislative Assembly by September 15, 2019. It sunsets the task force on December 31, 2019. It declares emergency and is effective on passage.
Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be here to discuss the intent of Senate Bill 434. As Mr. Domet mentioned to you, it is a task force. It will cost some money to administer the task force, so it'll have a small fiscal. I don't know whether this will require a referral, but it's in response to a little bit of bitter learning that we had over the effect of the Canyon Creek fire complex, which occurred in the John Day Valley a couple years back. When we were trying to assess the kinds of opportunities that might be available for relief of people who had lost their homes, we looked at all of the suite of potential programs that were out there, and one that we found was there's a wildfire damage financial relief fund. And you know, we were encouraged, because when you're in the initial response to a serious conflagration like that one, where 45 or so people lost everything, people look for hope and they look for a way forward. And when we discovered that there was a relief fund, we thought, well, we'll let people know that it's out there. And what occurred as a result of that is some folks actually made application for relief. And what they learned was that, first of all, there's the limitation on that relief is $5,000 per household, which isn't a lot, especially if you're looking at people who may have lost the accumulation of a lifetime and their primary residence. The other thing that occurred is that to qualify for that program, you had to have income threshold of 75% of the federal poverty level. And when we did the math on that, and I don't know if you have before you the matrix, but I'll certainly make sure that it becomes available to members of the committee. But a family of two living on Social Security, where only the primary breadwinner has a Social Security benefit and no other retirement, that would be $24,000 per year at the highest level for Social Security. The poverty level for a family of two, 100% of that would be $16,000. So at $16,000, that would be the number to which you'd apply the 75% limitation. If the family of two had an income of greater than $12,000, they wouldn't qualify. So literally, to qualify for wildfire damage financial relief fund, you'd had to have been homeless to begin with. There's just some anomalies in the law that we probably need to look at. If we're going to provide some sort of a damage relief for housing or a housing relief fund, we probably ought to step back and try to true up the realities. And even in a community like John Day, whose per capita income is only half what it is for the state of Oregon, the numbers just don't pencil. So what the bill does, very simple, it asks for a group of folks to come together, look at the current program, see if there isn't some recommendations they can make to produce a program that actually has some benefit for folks and bring recommendations back. There's a sunset. If there was an amendment, I would propose in consideration that it may also have to go to Ways and Means. There's no reason for the emergency clause on this bill. It just seems like when you put it in to legislative council, it just pops out with an emergency clause on it. So I would just point out that we've already had the emergency. We're looking at the aftermath. We're trying to prepare for the next emergency. But if this goes into effect 90 days after the conclusion of this legislative session, I don't think that would be such a brief time that the task force couldn't be named and shoulder their responsibilities and discharge them before 2019. So it doesn't need an emergency.
Would you be willing, Matt, to get an amendment requested?
Of course.
The emergency clause. Would you want any other changes to the bill or otherwise?
No, I think not. I mean, the point is that we have a number of members who just detest study bills. But I think in this case, we really do need to figure out, even if it's on the back of an envelope, five reasonable people sitting together can conclude this probably isn't a lot of help. It was never a lot of help to begin with, $5,000. But to limit it so strictly to 75% of the poverty level as a threshold, as an upper limit, that seems to be, may as well not even have that program.
Okay. Any questions for Senator Farrelly?
Thanks, Senator. I really applaud your bringing this bill to us. This is a serious problem. I was out at Canyon Creek and saw the devastation that caused. I wonder, though, if there wouldn't be a place here for people who are renting in these areas.
There is. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for them.
The bill talks about landowners. So
it does.
I wonder if it would be useful to have somebody who's a renter as part of the conversation.
It may be. And, Madam Chair, if I could respond. You know, work groups have a specific charge, but if their recommendations go beyond their charge, as far as I'm concerned, they get extra credit. So, yeah, this is specifically aimed at landowners and homeowners. And there's a way for rental owners to participate, but we have not aimed the bill at renters. But trust me, when folks are displaced, as you know from visiting, and there were several people that were renting up there, the hardship is just as great on them. They've lost everything as well. So.
Are you open to an amendment that expands that?
Sure.
Do you want to work with Matt we can make it all one amendment?
Okay.
Great. And I think we've got this posted for a possible work session on Wednesday. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
What's the emergency? The emergency?
What's your hurry?
To Wednesday?
Yes. All right. We'll do our best.
Okay. Very good. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, we just tell you that the folks in legislative fiscal have operators standing by for your call. I mean legislative council. They're always available.
All right. Thank you so much. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 434? Going. Seeing none, I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 434. Thank you, Senator Farrelly. And next up, I'm opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 594.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 594 restores the availability of the employment-related child care tax credit and extends the credit sunset. It increases the child care tax credit by doubling the applicable percentage of child care expenses allowed as credit. It applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2016 and before January 1st, 2022. It takes effect on the 91st day of following adjournment sine die.
Thank you, Senator Knope. Hello.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I wish one of your members was present, but he's gone. I am State Senator Tim Knope from Senate District 27, which I represent Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. And I brought you this bill today mainly because I've heard from constituents, both single moms and those that are married, that and some dads as well, that childcare costs have become a significant issue for them. And I want to really relate to you that, you know, their thoughts were that working parents in Oregon deserve to have affordable and quality childcare. And so this measure will help, I think, Oregonians bring about that opportunity. We have an opportunity, I think, really to restore access to a bigger tax credit. And there are several ways to do this. And so this bill really is a starting point because, unfortunately, one of the drawbacks, let's say, or the consequences, maybe more appropriately, of raising the minimum wage was also to raise childcare costs. Because, as you know, in daycare, there's a fixed amount of children that each individual can watch or oversee. And so when we increase labor costs, which it's a labor-intensive, obviously, industry, that being daycare and childcare, we raise the costs as a state to these parents. And in several of the cases that I was able to talk to constituents, they were spending 30% or more of their gross income on childcare. And essentially, when I started to look at it, I realized that, you know, for each infant care, it was about $11,000. And, nationally, to take care of a toddler, it was in the range of $8,700. But unfortunately, in Bend, those costs are even higher. And so really, it looked like the average in a really nice facility where you'd want to leave your child was about roughly $11,000, no matter whether you had an infant or you had a toddler or a child up to 4 years of age. And so a mother with, or parents with two children, are spending $22,000 a year on childcare. And in many cases, that's more than one-third or way more than one-third of their total income. And so it's really important, I think, that the legislature act on doing what we can do to make childcare more affordable. So this particular bill is one way to get at that, although I think we do need to remember that we did expand the child care tax credit in 2015 and merged those tax credits together. And so, you know, I'm not particular about how we do this. I mean, we could go back to the an old formula and have two tax credits, but you might decide that it's more efficient to have one. I know there are others who will testify about a different program as a way to get at that. But whatever we do, we need to do something that is substantial, because this is going to become an increasing problem. Because, as you know, the minimum wage has stepped to increase, and there's a pretty big increase coming this year. And so I think we need to do what we can do to mitigate those cost increases and help parents out, because you know, it's getting harder and harder. We've seen in this legislature concerns about housing costs and the escalation of those, and we've no doubt you've heard from constituents like I have that healthcare costs have significantly gone up, and with parents who have kids under five that are not in school, their childcare costs are also rising pretty rapidly. And so we need to do what we can to help these parents and single moms. And I would also say that from a standpoint, you know, I know we're going to look, this is actually in another committee, but some of us serve on that committee, we're going to look at pay equity. And for a single mom, this, I think this issue plays into that, because they're spending a lot of money on childcare, And, you know, that's disposable income. And so, you know, that's all part of what they're going to take home and ultimately give to somebody else. And so I think we're going to lose really qualified and talented women out of the workplace if we don't act to do something for the costs of childcare that are ever increasing. So I don't think this bill is the end of what we need to do, but I think it's a first step and a beginning. And I'm open to other thoughts on the issue, but I just wanted to highlight the issue and make sure that we were paying attention to it and working on it. And this seems like a great committee to do that. And so with that, I would be happy to answer questions that I can. And if not, I know you have other people who wish to testify as well.
So now's our big chance to ask questions of Senator Knope.
That's right.
Madam Chair. Thank you. I will say, Senator, since you brought up the minimum, the increase in the minimum wage, we did, as we were discussing it last year, was it just last year?
I guess it was just last year.
Yeah. You know, we did talk about the need for the state to step up and, you know, do its part. I mean, on the one hand, we need these workers to be well paid. But we understand that these are fixed costs that devolve upon, you know, people who are benefiting from state services. So we have, I believe, a responsibility to look at all of our human services expenses to make sure that while we're certainly, you know, I continue to believe we did the right thing in focusing on giving people a living wage, workers a living wage, we have to look at all the consequences.
Madam Chair, Senator Dembrough, I completely agree that, you know, when government acts and attempts to solve a problem, you know, we've sort of created another consequence to that. And this is just one of those consequences that I think is going to be relatively immediate. I was told by one of one of the moms that came to me that she checked with her daycare provider, and she basically said for about every 50 cents in the minimum wage, in rough numbers, it's about $50 increase per month. And so we're going to see kind of that stacking go on over the next 2 or 3 years. And, you know, is every facility going to be $50 a month no matter what? No. I mean, someone might be 25, someone might be 75, you know, someone might be 30. But, you know, you start doing the math and you go, well, you know, that's 300 maybe at a minimum, and, you know, $600 to $1,200 a year increase. And so I think we do have an obligation to do what we can to mitigate those increases and, you know, help out working parents because, you know, we need these parents and their expertise in the workforce. And we obviously want to make sure that they don't have any concerns about, you know, the care that their children are going to be in while they're in the workforce. And so I thank you for bringing up that point.
Senator Murphy-Henderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I as I was door knocking during my campaign, I ran into a single mom with two kids and low income. But she had to arrange her schedule or find a job where she could be home to take her kids to school, then work, and then have the job quit so she could go pick up her kids. Because when she penciled it out, there was no way that she would be able to afford childcare. So for low-income women also, they are making decisions to not put their kids in daycare and try to scrape by in whatever way they can, either having neighbors or a grandma or whoever taking care of the kids. So we do need to have a conversation about this. Thank you.
Chair Gelser, I just want to respond to that if I can. Chair Gelser, Senator Mona Sanderson, that also, I think, brings up the point of equity, and that being that when we put people in a position to limit their choices on the type of employment they can have because they can only do certain jobs that fit into that you know, that arena of where they can avoid their child care costs because they can't afford it, we're also limiting their ability probably to get into higher paying professions. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you know, I see that also as kind of a pay equity issue, because lots of what's going on in the pay equity arena has to do with the limited choices that some people have as it relates to their employment that they can choose. And so to the degree that we can expand that range for, you know, the constituent that you ran into, the better off likely she will be, and the better off we'll be as a community and a state.
Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair. You know, I'm struck again by what a tragedy it is for us as a country that the people who are doing this really important work are paid so little. Yeah. You know, that's a big part of the challenge. That the reason the rise in the minimum wage is an issue here is that so many of them are working, are being paid minimum wage or close to it. It's I don't know what the answer to that is, but I think it's a structural tragedy.
Yeah, Senator Gelser, Chair Gelser, Senator Dembro, I think a lot of us have looked at, obviously, the inequity that happens, you know, where we have, you know, people who can hit a ball or, you know, swing a racket, you know, make incredible amounts of money. And, you know, there's even some politicians that make incredible amounts of money. But yet some of the most important jobs that there are, which is nurturing children and, you know, taking care of our seniors and things like that, they make very little, and like you said, almost minimum wage, sometimes, you know, slightly above. But certainly, you know, those people are doing Hall of Fame type jobs, yet, you know, the pay doesn't follow that. So there's obviously not equity, you know, in our society in everything, you know, because I think our society sometimes misplaces the value of certain things. But there's no doubt that as it relates to child care, that it would be great if we could encourage people to go into that field where they could make a living. And I think right now it's pretty tough. And I know that we have a daycare across the street from where I work. And so, you know, we get to see pretty much everybody who works there and all the parents who drop their kids off and all the kids. And so, you know, in the morning and the afternoon, we're, you know, we're seeing this take place. And typically what you see is the people that are working in these daycare centers tend to be on the younger side, and potentially college students who are, you know, balancing both, you know, going to school as well as working in it. And then you have some people who may be longer term, but they're by no means highly paid employees, and they certainly deserve all the pay that we can give them. But I hope that we can make some progress this session in solving or helping to alleviate a problem that I think is going to keep many parents from making decisions that they would otherwise like to make to improve the lot of their family, which is, you know, getting a great job or keeping a great job and finding the kind of quality care that they want for their kids.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, next up we've got Kate Newhall, James Barta, and Jody Weiser.
Thank you, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, and I'm here today testifying on behalf of Family Forward Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today and share with you some of the concerns that we have about Senate Bill 594. Family Forward typically supports proposals that make child care more affordable for working families, but we do have concerns about focusing on tax credits to address child care affordability. As you just heard, it's no surprise to any working parent that child care is far too expensive and it's unaffordable for many Oregonians. A 2015 report from the Oregon State University found that the median cost of child care can be nearly twice as much as college tuition at Oregon's public universities. The same report found that child care costs increased 19% between 2004 and 2014, and yet household incomes declined by 5%. This is particularly challenging for households headed by single mothers who pay the same prices, but whose incomes are 43% of that of all households. And yet, at the same time where working families are struggling to afford child care providers are struggling with low wages, and we need to be investing in and supporting this workforce so that they aren't reliant on social service programs themselves. At Family Forward, we believe in systemic changes that allow all families to access affordable and quality childcare, and that we need significant public investments in our childcare infrastructure and our subsidy program to achieve this goal. We do appreciate the attention that Senate Bill 594 gives to the issue of childcare affordability, but we see tax credits as a limited approach that do little to help low-income families afford their childcare expenses that happen month to month, not just once a year when tax refunds come. We also know that tax credits are not free, and we believe that the same low-income families this bill targets would instead be better served by a significant investment in our child care subsidy program, the employment-related daycare program. We have long advocated for increased investment in ERDC, which we believe is an effective program that helps families afford child care expenses each month by directing the subsidy straight to the care provider and allowing families the flexibility to choose the right arrangement for their child, whether that's a family member or a center-based care. And importantly, ERDC also incentivizes quality care arrangements because it's based on a reimbursement rate for providers that are linked to quality and training metrics. Unfortunately, while ERDC is a good program that works for families, there are an estimated 40,000 families in Oregon who are eligible, income eligible for the program. And yet we have only budgeted this program to serve 8,100 families. It's our opinion that until the employment-related daycare program is fully funded for all eligible families, tax credits do little to solve the problem families face in accessing affordable quality child care every month. In addition, tax credits don't serve as economic drivers, whereas subsidy programs like ERDC do. In order to encourage individual financial stability alongside building a robust statewide economy, we need an educated and stable workforce, which means investing in the social infrastructure that allows women to work. We do believe that we need to make a significant investment in child care affordability through the employment-related daycare program. We recognize that in order to make the kind of significant investment that Oregon and working families need, we will also have to generate substantially more revenue in this state. The legislature is currently contemplating significant cuts to important programs like ERDC at a time when we should actually be looking to grow these valuable and life-changing programs. We're faced with an important choice this session. We must either raise significant new revenue or make draconian cuts to the services that families rely on. The fact that Oregon ranks dead last in what our businesses pay in taxes while working families struggle to make ends meet is unconscionable. We need significant and substantial new revenue in this state, and it's time that businesses and corporations who benefit greatly from state services pay their share. For these reasons, Family Forward is opposed to Senate Bill 594, although we do appreciate the attention and focus on making child care more affordable. Thank you.
Thank you. James.
Senator Gelser, members of the committee, James Barta. I'm the legislative director for Children First for Oregon and United for Kids, and I'm here to express my appreciation to the sponsor of the bill because, as was already testified to, that families, especially single mothers with children, they face a very difficult obstacle when it comes to child care. Child care expenses, in some cases, are more expensive than housing, and we all know in the discussion about housing, as the senator has already spoken to. And so I'm glad that this discussion is happening here because we definitely need it. And a few more words about the employment-related daycare. This is something that's in our children's agenda that was one of the most popular programs. We had scores of groups sign up in support of improving and expanding upon it. And I feel that, again, echoing, the previous comments, you know, when you look at a program that is only serving 18% of the eligible families, we know we don't have a sufficiently funded program. Now, at the same time, tax credits have their role. And last session, we did indeed have a combination of the child dependent care and working family tax credit. And, you know, for some of the families, that tax credit reaches in that new combined form when you combine with federal credits, you know, 75%, which is helpful. But for a lot of these families, tax credits, especially the poorer ones, it's difficult to utilize the credit. There's a couple problems with it. One is that it doesn't occur until the end of the year, and they're often living month to month. We live in a state where EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit, is what our utilization rate is, one of the lowest in the country. So we need to improve how our tax credits are done here in the state, and I think and how they're utilized by people, whether it's, you know, agency advertising or different things. And so I'm looking forward to a continued discussion on the idea of how tax credits can help supplement a lot of these working families. But for the poorest families, we're definitely seeing a program that that is not fully funded, that even in the current service level budget is going to see cuts due to increased federal requirements and background checks and such. And so, again, I do want to emphasize that I think this bill is a good start to discuss this issue, and appreciate the senator sponsoring it.
Thank you very much. Jody.
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser, speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to meet before you. I'm hardly ever in this room. So this tax credit bill asks that all taxpayers help with the cost of child care for employees who are selected not because of their financial need, but because their employers are willing to provide child care. My neighbors are mostly members, households that have two PhDs, and their families that can afford, because they have high-wage jobs, $800,000 homes. One father takes his daughter with him to work at Nike every day, and it's a lovely, really lovely work-life combination, but it's not a family we need to be helping. And my guess is they're one of the 12 corporations that has been using this tax break, and it means that the taxpayers are subsidizing that child care at the rate of $2,500 a year. And that doesn't seem like where we should be spending our child care dollars when there are families that are suffering instead that we're not providing help for. When this bill was up for its sunset in 2015, no businesses that used it came forward and said, we need to keep this alive. They do have to apply to use it, and so there are records someplace in the state about who does use them, but that's because of our transparency laws. We don't know who they are. I would suspect that it's mostly some big corporations like Nike, some CPAs who are providing child care for themselves and their employees at the daycare center downstairs, and daycare centers who provide child care for their employees' children as part of the benefit for working there. But that's a guess because we don't have transparency. Given that income eligibility is a part of virtually all our other child care subsidies, restarting this tax credit seems inappropriate, but it is definitely a problem. I think that many of our families experience the same thing as we were raising young children. It's like, can you afford to go to work, or is it cheaper to stay home? And in my case, I sold Avon during those years. And I think that a lot of families struggle with that, but there are families, particularly single-parent families, that have no choice, and this is not likely to help very many of them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Thank you all very much. And next we've got Rhonda Morgan and Eva Ripito.
Hello. Hello, Chair Gelsler and members of the committee. I'm really nervous, so bear with me. Okay. My name is Rhonda Morgan, and I'm an SEIU member, and I work for the Department of Human Services in Gold Beach as a TANF case manager, so I determine eligibility for the employment-related daycare program. I see how much impact that has on the families that I work with on a day-to-day basis. I see how they struggle with not finding childcare, with not having enough childcare providers, and not being able to afford it without the state subsidy when they can find them. I'm here to testify in opposition to this bill, to Senate Bill 594. Well, we all agree we absolutely have a problem with access to affordable childcare in Oregon. This probably isn't the most effective way to resolve that. Tax breaks are a good thing, right? They can be. It's kind of nice to see them. We're looking at them for individual families. But it doesn't help families pay on a month-to-month basis. It just doesn't. When people are paying, are living paycheck to paycheck, a tax break is not going to pay the daycare bill. It just isn't. In order to provide assistance to those who need it most, we need to be looking at raising revenue. We need to be looking at how do we expand programs like the employment-related daycare program. And we need to be doing that before we start talking about tax breaks and tax credits. ERDC currently only has enough funding to serve less than 20% of the families that qualify for it. And it's a program that subsidizes the monthly cost of childcare. It doesn't pay the whole thing. Families pay into that as well. It is a good program, and it needs to be more fully utilized, but we can't utilize it more fully without being able to fund it. Thanks for letting me testify today.
Thank you. Chair Gelsler, members of the committee, thanks so much for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 594, right?
Yes.
Sorry. I was like trying not to flip it in my head. I'm Eva Ripito. I'm with Oregon AFSCME Council 75. We represent licensed in-home child care providers across the state and a few Head Start employees around the state as well. Others in who have already testified, I do appreciate the conversation around the cost of child care. Child care is far too difficult to afford for too many families. The National Women's Law Center research shows that in most communities across the country, a family needs to make at least 200% of federal poverty level to be able to afford basic needs that include child care. I was jumping around all over the place. Child care providers, like all caregiving providers, are paid dismal wages. They are charged with providing care for our most precious and most vulnerable members of society, yet make wages that keep them eligible for many of the public services that are potentially on the chopping block this session. So I appreciate very much the conversations around wages. We need to raise the wages of our care providers, child care, in all areas. And we also need to take into consideration how that impacts the families that those services are provided to. In my very humble opinion, after doing work on child care and learning about employment-related daycare and tax credits over the last 6.5 years, I think that the only way to really get to an affordable child care system is to make investments in it like we do our K through college system. Because without those investments, child care will remain to be unattainable for far too many families and will keep those wages at a low rate and keep those providers in the system of needing public assistance as well. So I appreciate the time, and I look forward to more conversations about how to make child care affordable and raise the wages of our providers.
All right, thank you very much, Eva. Any questions for this panel? Senator Olson.
Thank you. Ma'am, you said that they need to make 200% of the federal poverty level. Could you put a dollar amount on that?
Chair Gelsler, Senator, or Vice Chair Olson, excuse me. In the National Women's Law Center, I was like, oh gosh, it just flipped. It says a family with an income above 200% of poverty, which is $40,000 a year for a family of three, could not qualify for assistance in 39 states, yet in most communities across the country, a family needs an income at least equal to 200% of poverty to meet basic needs, including housing, food, childcare, transportation, healthcare, and other necessities. And that's based on the Economic Policy Institute's data.
Follow up. Hello? And did you say the poverty, the level that they were looking at was $40,000, so they need to make $80,000 for a family of three? Somebody could,
a family with an income above 200% of poverty, which is $40,000 for a family of three.
But so I guess the question is the $40,000, the poverty level is $40,000 twice. Is that the 200% or is that the 100%?
It's the
200%. That's, excuse me, Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson. I believe the way I'm reading that, that is the 200% of FPL.
So to clarify, they need to make $40,000 a year, a family of three.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, I believe that is correct.
Okay. Follow?
Follow?
Which goes back to one of the things I've argued about in this state for the last 6 years. We need better paying jobs. We need to work on industry coming in here to provide jobs that pay $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year instead of minimum wage jobs, which is what we're geared toward right now. And I can understand why the folks that are in daycare have trouble because they're getting minimum wage, which just jacked up the cost to the people that have to use daycare because their prices just went up. So I think one of the things we need to look at, and we can all probably come together on the same page in this, is how do we get the governor to go out and bring an industry that pays jobs that pay $50,000, $60,000, and $70,000 a year so that we can get these people into those jobs instead of wallowing around in mediocrity? Have you got any ideas?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, I don't disagree that we need to have an economy based on higher paid jobs. I would also say that it would benefit the workforce to have allow for them to collectively bargain with their employers to make sure that they have wages that ensure that they are able to afford their basic needs like housing, transportation, food, health care, and child care.
But your
follow up.
But your two unions collectively bargain with the state, which is amazing that the state's a bad employer. And I agree with you because I know what I make, and I'd like to do collective bargaining for us, but we can't do that. So no. But the fact is that
we're gonna write that down. Or are you gonna?
Yeah.
It?
The fact is we need to drive forward to the powers that be that we need better higher wage jobs in this state rather than relying on minimum wage jobs and then trying to supplant with taxes from other people to bring up their I don't want to bring their life down. I want to bring our lives up, and that's the way we need to look at this rather than the other way. And yes, you're right, it's extremely difficult, and it's a process that we haven't done. And you can tell this when you look at the fact that we've had to raise minimum wage, but when you lose one $70,000 a year job and replace it with six $20,000 a year jobs, it doesn't help the people in the $20,000 a year jobs. And the guy with the $70,000 a year job has lost his. He's working at minimum wage. Mm-hmm. That's what hurts the state. That's where we need to be, at least in my opinion.
So, and let me
is this
ask
a follow up or a follow up to my follow up?
Well, no,
I guess you can do it.
You're the chair. You're right, aren't I? I forget.
I'm the steward here now, right? Did I get that job?
So, going back to the bill itself and something that Sandra Olson said, that the argument, if I understand it, that you are making is that the individuals that would benefit from the tax dollars, as you talked about, spending other people's tax dollars to address these, would be higher income people that are in a narrow set of mm-hmm. employers that are offering a higher quality of daycare. And the argument that you are making is that tax money would be better invested in employment-related daycare that is more targeted to the people that are applying for TANF, that are trying to move into those higher paid positions, which, as Senator Knope pointed out earlier, you can't always do that because you've got that barrier of, if I can't afford childcare, I can't work the extra hours, I can't work and go to school, I can't do these things to advance myself up the career. Am I understanding your argument?
Chair Gelser, yes. House Bill 2015 2015 legislative session, there were expansions to employment-related daycare that added instructional hours for people who are in school. We also added back self-employed, so people who are self-employed could apply for ERDC, and that had been a longstanding benefit, but then was cut when we started putting caps on the number of families that we were serving. I was like, I know there were some other additions too, but I think what would be really helpful is, we also did the step out. You enter at 185% or below, and you step out at 250%, so that you don't have that complete cliff effect. But I think what would be most beneficial is that if families up to, like, the most ideal would be like 400% of FPL, but I don't think we'll ever, at least in this session, get to the be able to, have people step out. And we also need to have lower co-pays too for families. That's a big barrier, as well, is that we're one of the states with the highest level of co-pays for families. So even when they are able to get the subsidy, depending on where they are, in the income range, their copay goes up, and we need to figure out ways to help lower copays. And we, when we're able to help families and have those direct subsidies go to providers, the providers are able to have their wages raised too. With the pressures around improved quality, they have more hours of professional development, especially if they're on the what we're now calling SPARC, but previously we've called the Quality Rating and Improvement System. So for basic licensing requirements, they have any provider that has staff, they and their staff are required to take hours of training, and then if they're on the QRIS or SPARC, then they have more hours to do. So that is a cost driver as well. I don't remember where I was going with that, but yes. So subsidies, and then funding it like we were the education system would be great. It would greatly improve accessibility, affordability, and the wages in the workforce.
Okay. So thank you. I think that the question, and I am really grateful to you, Senator Knope, for bringing up the issue. I think there's no question at all that child care affordability, and frankly, elder care affordability, just the affordability of care, mm-hmm. is one of the greatest challenges that all of us face, and that ongoing question of how do you get at it? Do you get at it through subsidy? Do you get at it through tax credit? Is one that it's hard to find the place to have that conversation, but I would be interested, as we kind of get through some of the bills, coming back and maybe doing an informational hearing and looking at how different states are balancing these things and what the impacts are for people in terms of retention and employment, advancement in employment with initiatives that are tax credit based or subsidy based, and hopefully we can bring that back to this committee a little later in the session.
That'd be great. And I know my friends have lots of information about that as well as I.
I've seen that in my email box, so, for which I'm really grateful. And then, Rhonda, I just wanted to say, you mentioned that you were nervous, but it's very difficult to tell that. So you're very good at this, and you should come back often.
And you can tell those of us that do it all the time still get nervous, too.
Are there any other questions for this panel?
Thank you.
Seeing them. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that would like to make comments on Senate Bill 594? No? So, committee, we can keep talking about Senate Bill 594, or we can adjourn an hour early. It's up to you.
We're gone.
All right. With that, I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 594, and we are adjourned. Bill 594, and we are adjourned. Hearing on Senate